This is the Medicast, October 1st, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 86. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome you all to this podcast. As you are listening to this, I have just gotten back from the Podcast and Portable Media Expo, and I'm sure, very excited about everything I picked up out there, all of the other podcasters that I had a chance to meet with and share ideas with, and things we could do to make the Medicast a better podcast for all of you and easier for me to produce a little bit, maybe. So I'm looking forward to learning some automation things and implementing some tools to assist with that, as well as meeting other podcasters that I have listened to for some time and been in contact with. So it's a good time for me to get involved with all of that. But here we're talking about EMS and emergency medical services in the field and in the hospital and anywhere else it might be found. So if you are a brand new listener to the show, I want to welcome you to the Medicast podcast. Check out medicast.com. You'll find all the entries on the blog over there. And in the left-hand side, you go down, you'll find the categories area and click on the podcast link. Will take you to all of the podcast episodes. Links in the show notes there, as well as links to listen to or download the podcasts themselves, all right there on the website, as well as all of the other information that I post there. And of course, for all you long-term listeners, I want to thank you again for just being subscribed, contributing your comments, your links, your news, everything else you've put into this show and made it a great community effort. Not a whole lot of email this week since I'm pre-recording. Really haven't gone through the whole week like I usually do. And so there's just a few items. First of all, I want to thank Chris Black for his comments on dealing with motor vehicle accidents and individuals who may have been ejected and missed during the initial survey of the scene. And he has a comment he placed over in the show notes that deal with that. So I'll let you go over and check out his comment at the website yourself and see what you have to think about it. If you have a comment you'd like to add or your own anecdote about individuals being missed at accident scenes where you didn't realize there were additional people in the vehicle, all of that you can do over at the website and leave a comment there. And again, Chris, thanks for your comments. I will be meeting with several health podcasters, kind of an informal meetup to get together and have a bite to eat and share some stories, talk about podcasting, several physicians, as well as some other health-related podcasters that are going to meet up in Ontario, California on Thursday night, and I'm looking forward to doing that. In the meantime, you can always contact me here at podmedic@mac.com. And also at the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is the voicemail line for the Medicast. Listener Heath checked in by email with some comments on body armor. I wonder how many of you actually wear body armor in the field. I really don't feel it's necessary in my community. It isn't that dangerous a place to be, but I could imagine EMS providers needing body armor when providing in areas like a major metropolitan area. So I'm curious, if you wear body armor, where did you get it? Did you have to provide it yourself? Did your service provide it for you? Is it something you're allowed to do or not allowed to do? I'd be curious. So please send me your comments. I'd be interested in finding out a little bit more about that. And I may post some of Heath's comments up on the website so you can see what he has to say about body armor as well. Okay, it's time to jump into this week's news items. I have a lot of stuff that I always talk about. One of the things that comes up quite frequently is the manpower shortage in the EMS workplace. The fact that we can't keep crews for a variety of reasons, both a shortage of trained personnel and a burnout factor that happens as people age and are unable to physically continue to do the demands of the job, as well as just lack of good pay. Good EMTs and paramedics moving on to better paying jobs because they just can't afford to work in the highly trained position they're in at the low pay that they end up receiving. This is true in an article I found over at emsresponder.com talking about a rural shortage of paramedics in Georgia. It's a statewide shortage, really, but it's more profound in sparsely populated areas where they can't pay as much for providers. And when people call 911, they have longer transport times both to the scene and on to the hospital. And so they've run into lots of problems where 911 centers are getting calls and there are no ambulances or crews to get the ambulances out to people. And this is a big deal. You know, we got to address this. It's not going to go away on its own. We need to do something to adequately provide for better pay for emergency medical responders. We spend a lot of time in training. We truly are medical professionals. And we shouldn't be paid the same or less than every other vehicle driver, vehicle passenger, or whatever else you might think of out there. We just don't get a lot for what we do. And hopefully, as states become more and more crunched on this, there's going to have to be some type of give and take, and hopefully more give than take. I know we're all working a lot more hours, putting a lot more time in, whether we're paid or volunteer providers. And so I hope that Georgia is able to solve this problem. And I hope that nationally there is a way for people to figure out a way around the shortages that are out there, because it's just going to get worse. Speaking of getting worse, the cold and flu season is fast upon us, and it's that time of year for those of us in healthcare professions to start thinking about getting our flu shots. But really, infection control is an all-year kind of thing. And so I found a great article over at WebMD that is talking about hand washing, and it's called Hand Washing 101. And it talks about really why it's just so important to make sure that you wash your hands frequently. It's difficult for us in the field to wash our hands prior to seeing every patient like they do in the hospital. But you can get the hand gel and use that when you get out of the ambulance. And also make sure you're wearing your gloves. So all of the scene safety, BSI kind of stuff goes in hand here. But when you're done, you need to wash your hands at the hospital or at the nursing home, wherever you end up transporting. The last thing you do after you unload a patient and remake your stretcher is go wash your hands. And it's just really, it's so important. Studies have shown that about 80% of infectious diseases are transmitted solely by touch, and that maybe 36,000 people die each year in the United States from flu or flu-like illnesses. And think about that. 80% of those deaths could be potentially prevented by more people using good hand-washing techniques. So how do you do this? Well, I've heard a lot of different ways of doing it. They want you to lather for about 15 seconds and then rinse completely. Dry off your hands and turn off the faucet with your paper towel. And so how long is 15 seconds? Sing happy birthday to yourself. That's one of the rules I learned. And you know, it's easy to do. You just take a few extra seconds, get the job done. You stay healthier, your family stays healthier, and your patients stay healthier. The next item looks at healthcare and what Americans think about the healthcare system. Interestingly enough, according to the survey that this article cites, there is a relationship between the Americans' lack of belief in the healthcare system, for the most part, and a lack of faith in the FDA to manage safe medication, prescription drugs, and other things monitored by the FDA. And it was found in this study that most Americans have no idea what the Food and Drug Administration does, how they approve drugs, and so therefore, almost half of the people in the study judge the agency's performance as poor. Now, recently, the federal government has reacted and has put in place a bill that is going to bolster the Food and Drug Administration's budgeting, as well as expand some of the powers that they have. And it's got the support of consumer advocates and other representatives as a step in the right direction towards reforming some of the issues in healthcare having to do directly with the FDA. But one of the things the study found was that most Americans believe that the U.S. healthcare system is broken. Well, you know, I think that most of us would agree that there's something broken. If it's not the whole healthcare system, there's definitely a broken link in the cog somewhere. And more than 3/4 of the people believe that a candidate's position in the upcoming election on drug safety is somewhat important. In fact, many of the people interviewed believe that the healthcare system ranks second only to the war in Iraq. So I guess we need to educate people better about what the FDA does and what its charter is, how it works, and doing more. And you can check out a lot of that information directly in the article that I found over at medicinenet.com. There will be a link directly to it in the show notes so you can check that out. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about an article I found over at medicalnewstoday.com. And this article looks at teen obesity in the U.S. and links teen obesity directly to exposure to unhealthy food choice items and options, as well as poor policies in places like physical education programs in the schools, poor policies in nutritional education, and money spent to teach and educate via other avenues, such as advertising on television and other options. All of these things linked together. Now, this comes from a collection of 11 papers by United States researchers published this past week talking about the fact that American obesity in childhood is so high and increasing because families are finding it difficult to make appropriate food and diet choices and are unaware or unable to correctly identify how to make those correct choices by reading a food label. One of the lead researchers, Dr. Frank Chalupka, professor of economics from the Department of Economics and the Institute for Health Research and Policy at the University of Illinois Chicago, said, "We have in our schools and community a perfect storm that will continue to feed the childhood obesity epidemic until we adopt policies that improve the health of our communities and our kids." So, and that's a very strong statement. That's basically saying that the entire system for raising children in a healthy environment with healthy choice options and healthy education is broken. We have schools that are increasingly having to meet so many academic goals brought into them from the outside that they find it necessary to cancel all recess and other structured and unstructured physical activity in favor of teaching children to pass tests so the schools could continue to get federal funding. Now, I guess I'm on a soapbox here. There's a lot of teachers in my family, so bear with me here. But that's not the only problem. There are problems in the way our media is portraying food. There's a problem in the way that processed foods and other unhealthy options are so much less expensive than healthy food choices like fresh vegetables and produce that people who have limited budgets are really hampered by the ability of them they have to buy healthy food choices. So there's it's across the spectrum, and that's what the doctor was saying when he looked at this issue. He said it's a broad spectrum problem that reaches all sectors of how we raise our children, from parents to schools to communities to media, all of us. And you know, that means we're part of that picture too. What are we doing in our communities to deal with healthy education? Again, it comes back to that preventative medicine side, you know, that little mention of we should be involved with preventative medicine. Well, aside from teaching CPR and other community-based action, what else do we do? Perhaps our agency can sponsor a local youth league. Maybe our agency can provide coaches for some teams. Sports teams of different varieties. All of these things can go a long way to helping to increase activity in kids. At the same time, we can provide handouts from the health department because we have that connection, right? We connect with the hospital and the health department. We can provide information about healthy lifestyles at the same time we're providing them information about how to play a sport. So all of this goes hand in hand in hand, and it needs to be a total community approach. And so I really was heartened by this article in some respects and disheartened in others because I think it lays out exactly what needs to be done, at least as far as having a broad spectrum community-based approach. It's not just McDonald's fault. It's not just fast food's fault. It's not just processed sugar products' fault. It is the fault of a lot of different places and ways of dealing with kids because they don't provide structured activities, get them out from under in front of televisions and out doing activities as well as learning healthy eating habits. All right, so enough of me on my soapbox about youth obesity in America. That will wrap up this week's news items. I kind of flew through them there, but again, I'm trying to get all packed up and ready to leave for the podcast expo, and I wanted to make sure I got a whole episode together for you. I've got a great interview coming up now for the tip and trick of the week this week with Dr. Mike from the Pediacast podcast. Anybody out there who's interested in learning more about what goes on in pediatric medicine, whether you're a parent or a medical provider, you're going to find a ton of great information. He interviews other physicians. He just had a recent episode on where he and a family practice physician talked about different types of rashes, how they're described, what they may represent. And this is going to be part of an ongoing process where they're actually going to go in more in depth on each type of rash on a monthly basis until they're finished. So that's just one example of the great content that Dr. Mike provides. He covers research topics and really brings it down to earth, makes it easy to understand. He answers questions sent in, and he does all this in a variety of different ways and really makes everything understandable. Just real quick, before we kick into the interview, I want to remind everybody, this is Dr. Mike's talking with us just for informational purposes only. We all need to make sure we're following our own protocols and following our own assessment guidelines, that he's not really making any definitive diagnosis decisions here. He's really talking in general about pediatric injuries. And that is the topic with Dr. Mike. We're going to be talking about pediatric sports injuries as we head into the fall sports season. So without further ado, here is that interview with Dr. Mike. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am here with Dr. Mike from the Pediacast podcast. And Dr. Mike, I'd just like to say thank you very much for taking some time to share your expertise here with the Medicast listeners.
Hey, I am happy to be here, Jamie.
Great. I was thinking of a topic. You and I were kind of emailing back and forth, and I was thinking of a topic that we could really use to apply this time of year, and it came to my mind that this would be a great time as kids in America and other parts of the Northern Hemisphere, at least, are starting back to school. We could talk a little bit about kids and sports-related injuries, because I think, you know, it's not the same with kids and adults. There are some key differences and to look for orthopedic and musculoskeletal injuries in children. And I think it's a good place for us to kind of tap an expert in some regards on this particular topic.
Yeah, there's no question that kids are definitely different than adults. And it's sometimes hard for coaches and teachers and even parents to understand that. But you're right, there are differences. And of course, the biggest one is, you know, the growth plate. So, you know, with kids are still growing, and so you have to be really careful that you don't disrupt the growth plate, because, you know, that can obviously cause problems with their growth, which creates lots of problems down the road.
Now, can there be it? Does it have to be an actual break to cause a growth plate injury, or can a sprain or a strain or some other like bruising injury also cause growth plate problems?
The growth plate is actually cartilage, so it's not really bone yet. So basically what happens is anything, you know, that's right near the area of the growth plate, whether it be a bad bruise or a severe sprain of the muscles around the joint, if there's a disruption of the growth plate, Through there, it can happen a lot easier than a fracture can, or a true bone fracture, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
So, and the other difficult thing with it is you think, well, you know, if you're worried about there being a fracture, you just get an X-ray, but because the growth plate is cartilage, it doesn't really show up on X-ray film very well at all, not like bone does. So if you have a small fracture through the growth plate or through that cartilage there, sometimes the X-rays can be negative. So you have to really know what you're doing in terms of doing the physical exam to assess whether there's any growth plate damage or not.
Yeah, that's good information. So we should really, as we do in so many things pertaining to children and emergencies, we really need to err on the side of caution. Even if we don't end up transporting, we should urge parents to at least touch base with their primary care physician. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And for most of them, you know, if it's something that, you know, they're not in a terrible amount of pain and there's not swelling or deformity, you know, it's usually something that can even wait until the next day, you know, and just see your doctor during regular office hours. But obviously, if they're in a lot of pain and they're just constantly crying and uncomfortable, or there's a lot of swelling or deformity. And of course, I'm sure when you guys see them, you know, you're checking to make sure that they're neurovascularly intact, that their pulses are okay, and they have feeling distal to the injury, that sort of thing. So if that's all normal, you know, it's certainly not something that they'd have to go to the emergency room for.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Dr. Mike, for that subtle reminder for all of you, especially you students out there listening to the show. Don't forget to check distal PMS, because that's one of those things that'll fail you in a testing situation. So
yeah, it's an important thing.
I have a lot of EMT and paramedic students listening to the show every week. And that's one of those things I harp on with them. You know, that's a stupid thing to get dinged on, but you got to make sure when you wrap something or splint something or checking to make sure you check that. So I'm glad you mentioned that as well. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
I was looking at trying to get some statistics on this. And the most recent numbers I could find in just a quick search online was CDC release of information in 2002. And they said that 1.9 million children in the United States will be seen in an emergency department for a sports activity related injury. And that's a shocking number. I mean, that's nearly 2 million children. That's a lot of kids. We're likely to see a lot of those kids, I would think, in emergency medical services.
Right. Now, of course, the problem is, and I'm guessing at numbers, but I would hazard a guess that, you know, maybe 10 or 15% of those really needed to be seen in the emergency department, that most of them could have waited till the next day to see their regular doctor.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, as well as I do, because you have those frantic parents calling you in the middle of the night too. And I actually was one of those parents once. I have to raise my hand and admit to being a little scared every now and then with my first, at least. But we get those same kind of calls. And I agree with you. I think probably 10 or 15% is probably a good number to say that those kids could probably wait and be seen in the doctor's office the next day during normal office hours.
And of course, I'm not being critical. I'm just because, you know, when you are a scared parent and you don't have someone there, you know, who's knowledgeable to assess and you're worried, then you should definitely go seek, you know, professional help and opinion. It's just kind of sad that a lot of people don't have a regular primary doctor that they feel they could call at 8 o'clock in the evening, you know, to just ask them about it. they just go.
Yeah. Or they call 911 and you know, you go and see their kid in that situation. And it's interesting because one of the things I picked up on in I just recently recertified for my pediatric education for pre-hospital providers, the PEP class, which the American Academy of Pediatrics puts out. And one of the things they discussed in there was, you know, that you really needed to trust parents' instincts and not blow off something that seems minor, because parents usually know the kids. And this is for us as EMS providers with our limited access to technology to assess these things. And so I have to agree with that. You know, if the parent's concerned enough after you've gotten there and done an assessment and they still are really concerned, it's important for us to get them to the next level of care and get them checked out. So I don't want to belittle that either.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
So what kind of injuries are we really most likely to see when we are dealing with kids that are dealing with organized sports and their injuries?
Sure. I think by far and away the most common are going to be soft tissue injuries. So you're looking at sprains and bumps and bruises and that sort of thing. Because it takes, I mean, it still does take a lot of force, you know, to cause a fracture, except when we're talking in the growth plate area. And again, you know, that's something. And by the way, the growth plate area is going to be typically on long bones, just up, you know, maybe, I want to say a one or two finger breadths above the joint and below the joint. So it's not right at the joint. It's a little bit above and a little bit below on the long bones. I mean, that's where you're going to be worrying the most. And of course, the ankle is probably the most sensitive of those areas, you know, the one that's probably damaged the most in terms of the growth plate.
All right. So down low on the lower extremity then is where you're likely to see.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, the growth plate's just right above the lateral and medial malleolus down on the ankle there. I mean, that's the growth plate on the tibia and the fibula. That's really where you want to make sure that they're, even as like, if, you know, I'm in an emergency room and I see a kid come in and they have a lot of pain there right at that spot, even if they, don't have swelling and the x-ray looks negative, but if they have point tenderness right at the growth plate, then we usually still put them in a posterior splint for a week and then get another x-ray a week later, because then as it heals, if there's a fracture there, you know, they'll start laying down new bone in the growth plate, and then you'll be able to, it lights right up and you can see it.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen that. You know, they don't wrap people in cast right away like they used to. It seems like that seems to be the standard right now, is to send them out with a half cast or some kind of a splint and wait, right, and see. Right.
And most of those kids will still be in a soft tissue injury, you know, and again, you'd rather overdo it than underdo it when you're talking about the growth plates, just because there's so much potential for long-term disability, you know, if you don't take care of it the right way. But I still think, you know, soft tissue injuries, sprains and then bumps and bruises, that's going to be the most common thing. I mean, you're going to see some fractures, and then you always worry about concussions too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's football season and you run into that whole thing. And I guess you want to make your pitch right now for proper equipment.
Oh, yes, definitely. And, you know, not only do you need proper equipment, but you have to make sure that the people who are in charge at the school know how to use it properly. And that would seem like it's, you know, a no-brainer, but that's not always the case. So, you know, as a parent, you may want to do your own research to make sure that everything's fitting properly. And if it's not, you know, raise concern with the coaching staff that, hey, this doesn't fit the right way. Because, I mean, the coach has a whole team full of players and they can't necessarily make sure that everything is, you know, A-okay. As a parent, you really have to advocate for your child.
Yeah, and I see that, especially in places where with the younger kids and you're doing rec league kind of activities. At the high school level, there seems to be more organization and there's usually a trainer that's involved with the team and is more has more expertise in properly fitting equipment.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Although in some rural communities, you know, then you have to, is the trainer just, you know, Joe at the barbershop, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Who doesn't necessarily have that, you know, really good specialized training. So you have to be careful about that too. Yeah. The word trainer is sometimes loosely interpreted in terms of what a person's background is.
Is it a title or is it a description?
It depends on where you are. I mean, certainly schools that are well funded with a big athletic program, there's no question that the trainers are going to be well trained. But you just, you know, I mean, you just can't take for granted that people, I mean, you're putting your kids' lives in their hands. You want to be educated as a parent and make sure that the right things are being done.
Absolutely. Now, what do you think about, you know, you hear this a lot in sports, the no pain, no gain mentality of, you know, you need to continue to practice hard, you know, work through the pain. Is that a problem in children?
Yeah, you know, I think that to some degree, as you are conditioning your muscles, there is going to be a little bit of pain, but the discomfort involved with that, you should still be able to get through it without, you know, superhuman stamina. You know, I mean, so you're going to have some aches and pains, but when it gets to the point where it's starting to interfere with your performance, then it's time to say, hey, we're causing damage at this point. You know, it's not just a healthy stretch. It's not just my legs being a little bit overtired, that you're actually doing damage at that point. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's training for a sporting team is going to be 100% pain-free, because especially if you're out of shape, as you're starting to do stretches and get your, you know, really get your stamina up, there is going to be a little bit of discomfort, but it shouldn't be so much discomfort that it affects performance.
Okay. That's I think, you know, and I think that sometimes parents push their kids and coaches push their kids, but really they need to pay attention to the severity of the pain. And you know, like you said, a little bit of pain is okay, maybe, but not if there's significant pain.
Yeah. And it has to be an objective view of whether it's affecting performance, because the student athlete, it's never going to affect performance from their point of view.
I have a daughter who has a juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and she's my athlete, strangely enough. So we have to actually watch her like a hawk, because she'll just keep going. She fights right through the pain because she's competitive, and you know, she's only 8, but it's like, Sarah Lynn, you're limping. You're not running anymore. Come off the field.
Right. And yes, exactly.
So
and once again, performance is affected even though they don't want to admit it.
Right. Now, also, we have had talks about heat-related problems, and even though it's cooling off here on the East Coast, it's still hot in plenty parts of the country. And so I wonder, you know, do you think the awareness level has come up far enough about proper hydration and practices and heat-related injuries?
I think in most circles it has. It's so important, you know, that there really be unlimited access to water or electrolyte solutions, you know, when kids are on the playing field in hot weather. I think more and more people are aware of it. Certainly the news, I think, recently has focused on it quite a bit. It seems like there's a lot of information out on the internet. And thinking back the last couple of years, I really have not come across too many heat stroke kind of situations, which is good.
It is good, because it's such a tragedy, because it's such a preventable problem. It brings me around to prevention, because when we talk about kids, at least in the EMS side, and I'm sure this is the case for you as well, but prevention is really the key. If we can prevent the injuries from happening to begin with. Do you have anything to talk about specifically that has to do with sports and prevention?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is way before the actual season is when you really have to start training. I mean, you can't go into the first practice cold and think that you're not going to have an injury, you know, especially a soft tissue injury, a strain or a sprain. Because you have to get your muscles ready. And so really, I think if kids stay active from the time that whatever sporting seasons that they, you know, do the end until the next one, they really should try to stay just as active as they can that entire time. So, I mean, if you let your muscles go cold, you know, it doesn't take long at all to lose everything that you've worked for.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really important to warm up, to do the stretches properly, you know, and to take care of any injuries that do pop up along the way. So that would be one. You know, certainly safety equipment, as we talked about, and using it properly is going to be another prevention. And then good technique. It depends on sort of what sport. You know, obviously there's less technique in terms of injury, you know, in baseball than there is in the high diving, you know. But so you want to make sure that you're learning proper technique so that you're not going to hurt yourself that way too.
That's all good points. And I talk a lot to the listeners about that they need to get out in their communities and educate people on how to do CPR and educate people on other topics. And usually it's related to adult issues. But this is one of those situations where maybe, you know, talking to a group of parents at a rec league, you know, getting out there and talking a little bit about prevention and making sure your kids are there on time to warm up properly before practice and things like that. Just a little short 15-minute blurb and let the kids climb around the ambulance is a great way to get this information out there on our end.
So, right. And as a parent too, another thing I would advocate for in your community is wherever you're doing the sporting events is to make sure that there's an AED device available, because they're so easy to use. I mean, it doesn't take much know-how. Just basically follow the, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 steps on the machine. And I mean, you could really save someone's life, but more likely a bystander, you know.
That is true. And I know that more and more states are coming online with that for at least high school sporting events. I know Maryland added that a year or two ago, where it's required now at every high school sporting event to have an AED on the property. Now, that means it's in the nurse's office, but it's still closer than it might be otherwise if we're calling an ambulance in a rural area. So,
right. And if you wanted to have a fun drive for, your local school district, that would certainly be something, you know, if the athletic department could have one, you know, that would be available during practices and during games. But that's something that, it's been a few weeks ago, but there was in PDA Cast, we talked about this. I think it was in the news segment, or maybe it was research, but in any case, it was out in Washington State. It looked at what the percentage of schools that had AEDs was. And it was a surprising number to me how many school districts had raised the funds themselves to buy it without any help from the state or actually official money from the school board.
I think maybe 3 years ago, we had an unfortunate death at a lacrosse event here in Maryland where a kid, you know, caught a mid-sternal blow, you know, in the middle of the game and dropped him. And there was, you know, nobody, they did CPR, but weren't able to get him back before the ambulance got there. And he ended up dying, unfortunately. And that really lit the fire.
Yeah, because an AED, you know, probably would have saved his life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this is great talking to you, Dr. Mike. Do you have any last word for the MedicCast listeners, the EMTs, paramedics, and students that are listening to the show?
You know, I would say check out PDA Cast at pdacast.org. And, you know, I actually have a lot of listeners who aren't parents who are just interested in child health issues of any kind. And certainly, you know, if you're a healthcare provider and including first responders who works with kids, we mix it up quite a bit. I mean, we talk about things that only parents would really care about, but then there's also broader child health issues that we talk about as well. So we do have a lot of medical students and residents and nursing students and physical therapy students that I hear from. So I'm sure that your listeners would get a lot of good pediatric information in PediaCast.
Excellent. Well, that was my last question was going to be, hey, you going to tell us how to find your show? I have to agree with you, though. Those of you that haven't checked out the PediaCast, get on over there and check the show out because it is full of information. There's a Q&A with parent questions coming in, and maybe it'll be something you'll have a parent ask you sometime, and you can at least point them in another direction or give them some assistance in answering questions. As well as, guys, when you listen to his show, Dr. Mike does a great job of bringing medical studies down to a level where you can understand what the heck they're talking about. And I really enjoy it. Actually, that's the segment of your show I look forward to the most, is when you really talk about research and what's going on out there with healthcare for children.
Yeah, you know, I hear that a lot, surprisingly. I was, when I first started doing it, I wasn't sure how well that segment would go. I was kind of leery to do it. But surprisingly, I get so many emails from moms and dads that really do appreciate that part of it. So I've kept it in there. I really enjoy doing it.
Well, great. Well, Dr. Mike, thank you very much. And I hope maybe we can have you back sometime again here on the MedicCast.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to.
Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Mike for taking the time to meet with me by Skype interview and check in and talk with us about sports injuries. And hopefully we can have Dr. Mike on again in the future to discuss different types of disease process in children and assessment techniques and everything else we can pick his brain about. Maybe even get him on a MedicCast Live so that other people can ask him some questions. In the meantime, again, I'd like to direct you over to his site at pediacast.org. And there's a link in the show notes. You can also find his podcast over at the iTunes store in the podcasting section and in a lot of different sites where they talk about different podcasts for pediatrics. So check this out. Dr. Mike's podcast is excellent, and I'm glad he was able to share some of his time with us today. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'd like to thank everybody for checking out the show. Don't forget, you can reach me here at the MedicCast by email by sending me an email at podmedic@mac.com and send me your questions, your comments, corrections, or anything else you might think of sending me. Always appreciate links if you have an interesting local news story you'd like me to take a look at. I can't always promise I'll put everything up, but I try to at least take a look at something, and I do try to reply to your email just to let you know that I got it. I also can be reached here at the podcast by the voicemail line, and this is a way for you to give me a little bit extra content to throw up on the audio podcast. So if you'd like to call into the voicemail line, here it is. Get your phones out. You can program it right in there. 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC. And so this is a way for you to catch up with me, leave your message, and at the very end, add your voicemail or email address just so I have a way to get back in touch with you in case I need to clarify your question before we put it on the show. Anyway, that's our contact information. As always, you can leave comments on the blog entries on the website. To any of those blog entries, just click on the comments button link at the bottom of each article, and you can leave your comments there. Ever listened to the show and wished you had the link with you right away or a way to remember to get that link so you could check out something I talked about? Well, you can do that by signing up for the free MedicCast newsletter. This email newsletter gets sent directly to you every week when the show gets posted, and it has all the email links or all the website links that I have in the show notes on the website at themedicast.com, and it's all sent directly to your email address. There's a link to sign up over at the MedicCast website in the upper right-hand corner. You'll see free MedicCast newsletter here. Click that link, fill in the information, and you'll be sent a confirmation email, and then you're good to go. And you'll get all this information sent directly to you, and it's a great way for you to stay up even better on the content we provide here on the show. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This week from a band called Jagstar from the PodSafe Music Network, over at music.podshow.com. Jagstar has got a recent CD release. They have their music available over at iTunes, and there's a link button to take you directly to the iTunes store if you'd like to purchase some of Jagstar's music. The song that I will be featuring tonight is called Missed Out. Great song and a great band. And if you like what you hear, please let them know you heard it here on the MedicCast and support the PodSafe artists that provide their independent music for us to play. It's something that helps everybody in the situation. I get a little extra content for my show, and you guys get to hear excellent independent music you may not have been able to check out otherwise. That's about it. So I'm going to wrap up, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.